Imagine being trapped at a late night faculty party with like the most toxic, brutally honest couple on campus.
Oh, that sounds like an absolute nightmare.
Right, the drinks are flowing, the insults are just flying everywhere, and for some reason you just can't bring yourself to leave.
You're completely glued to it because it's just so raw.
Exactly. It's claustrophobic, it's hilarious, and it is deeply, deeply uncomfortable. So welcome to today's deep dive. We are jumping into a really comprehensive breakdown of Edward Albee's masterpiece 1962 play, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf?
And we're pulling from a very detailed Wikipedia article on the subject to really get into the weeds here.
Yeah, and our mission today isn't just to recap the chaotic plot of like the ultimate bad marriage. We want to understand why this specific story and its central theme of reality versus illusion still fundamentally shapes our culture today.
Right. And to really grasp the impact of this piece, we have to look at the world it was born into.
The 1960s.
Well, the late 1950s and early 60s, yeah. This was the golden era of the nuclear family ideal. Coming out of the trauma of World War II, society desperately wanted order.
They wanted things to be neat and tidy.
Exactly. So they built this very picturesque, rigid facade. You had the stoic, capable breadwinner father, the cheerful homemaker mother, and, the perfectly well-behaved
A
children.
classic picket fence.
Yeah, it was an era defined by this almost mandatory false optimism. And then Albee just takes an absolute sledgehammer to that pristine facade.
He really does. But before we look at the wreckage, I think we need to talk about who is actually swinging that hammer because these characters were actually based on real people.
They were, which is wild.
Yeah. So we have two couples trapped in this living room. The older couple is George, who's an associate history professor who kind of lacks ambition and is completely stalled out in his career. And then his wife, Martha.
And the power dynamic there is crucial.
Oh, absolutely. Martha is the domineering daughter of the college president. So George works for his father-in-law, and he is just constantly failing to meet those expectations.
Right. And then you have the younger couple they've invited over, Nick, who is this young, highly ambitious biology professor, and Honey, his sort of mousy, easily intoxicated wife.
They represent everything George and Martha were supposed to be, right?
Exactly. But the inspiration for George and Martha actually came from Edward Albee's own social circle in New York.
Wait, really?
Yeah. They were based on Willard Maws, a literature professor at Wagner College, and Marie Menken, an experimental filmmaker.
Yep.
They were these New York socialites known for having an intensely volatile relationship.
And when we say they hosted salons, we aren't talking about polite networking over tea, are we?
Definitely not. According to the sources, their weekend drinking would start at like 4 p.m. on Friday and run continuously until the wee hours of Monday morning.
That is, I mean, it's like that one couple you follow on social media who constantly overshare their toxic drama. But instead of just vague posting about it from a distance, George and Martha are essentially trapping you in their living room for 3 hours with a fully stocked bar. You are just a captive audience to their misery.
What's fascinating here is that Albee took this hyper-specific, highly eccentric real-life relationship and used it as a vessel.
To say something bigger.
Exactly. He took their bizarre, alcohol-fueled weekend marathons to critique much broader, universally relatable feelings. Beneath all the shouting and the drinking, he's exploring profound inadequacy, failed ambition, and just the sheer terror of realizing your life hasn't turned out the way you planned.
So let's talk about how that actually plays out in the room. The evening kicks off with what feels like a heavyweight boxing match, basically disguised as parlor games.
Oh, Act One is literally called Fun and Games.
Right. And Martha immediately starts emasculating George in front of their new guests. She tells this incredibly embarrassing story about how she humiliated him by sucker punching him at a backyard party.
Just brutal.
And then she explicitly calls him a great big fat flop because her father expected George to eventually take over the college, and George simply couldn't do it.
And you have to think about the context of 1960s gender roles, right? Where a man's entire societal worth is tied to being a successful provider and a dominant figure. That is a lethal psychological strike.
So George's reaction to this humiliation is, well, it's really telling. He disappears, comes back into the room with a rifle, aims it directly at Martha, and pulls the trigger.
Which is terrifying for the guest.
Completely terrifying. But instead of a bullet, a Chinese parasol pops out of the barrel.
It's a shocking moment of violence that just suddenly deflates into a joke.
Yeah, it feels like a very deliberate subversion.
Yeah.
George is essentially saying, oh, you want me to be this dominant, violent, alpha male breadwinner? Well, here's your alpha male, a toy umbrella.
He's mocking his own inability to be the aggressive man society and his wife demand him to be.
Meanwhile, Honey is getting deliriously drunk on brandy and ends up running to the bathroom to vomit.
And that's just Act One. As the night drags on, the psychological warfare escalates. Well, B infuses the middle section of the story with this atmosphere of dark magic.
Almost like spellcasting.
Exactly. He even titled the second act Walpurgisnacht.
Which translates to what exactly?
It's traditionally the name of an annual witches' meeting, or Sabbath.
Wow. Fitting.
Very.
Yeah.
And the nightmare really begins when the characters start weaponizing their secrets. While the women are out of the room, Nick and George start drinking heavily and talking.
And Nick makes a mistake here, right?
A huge mistake. Nick reveals a deeply personal secret. He says Honey once had a hysterical pregnancy, which implies she basically trapped Nick into marrying her under false pretenses.
Yikes. And George counters with a story as his own.
Right.
He talks about a boy from his past who accidentally killed his mother with a shotgun.
Right.
And the kid ordered a bourbon to calm down, but mispronounced it as a Bergen.
A Bergen, yeah.
Then the following summer, that same boy was driving with his father, swerved to miss a porcupine in the road, and accidentally killed his father too.
It's so dark.
The boy ended up in an asylum, completely mute.
And the narrative deliberately blurs the line of whether George is actually talking about himself or just spinning a dark fable. But the real witchcraft happens when George launches a new game he calls Get the Guests.
Oh boy.
He takes the intimate secret Nick just handed him and turns it into a bomb. He tells a thinly veiled story to the whole room about a mousie who trapped her ambitious husband with a fake pregnancy.
Oh, man. So he completely humiliates Honey in front of everyone?
Yep, and she runs off to be sick again.
And Martha's response to George's cruelty is just to escalate the chaos. She blatantly seduces Nick in the living room, right in front of George.
And George's countermove is wild.
He just smiles and pretends to read a book.
Right.
Which enrages Martha so much she takes Nick upstairs.
Mm.
And then George waits until they are gone, and in a moment of absolute unvarnished rage, hurls his book against the house's doorbell chimes. We've all been in situations where someone uses a shared secret as a weapon under the guise of a joke, but George and Martha do it on a masterclass level. They extract the hidden truths from behind Nick and Honey's polite facade and just detonate them.
You know, I keep thinking about this. Have you ever sat through an excruciating dinner because it was your boss and you just felt like you couldn't leave?
Oh, absolutely.
That is what reading the source material feels like. But if the hostility is this blatant, why on earth do Nick and Honey stay? The door is right there. Why not just walk out the door?
Because they are completely paralyzed by polite societal norms. Remember, they are guests in the home of the college president's daughter.
Oh, right. You don't just walk out on your boss's family.
Not if you want tenure, you don't. They are bound by the very rules of etiquette and ambition that George and Martha have completely discarded. In many ways, the younger couple represents the shiny, polite facade of the American dream.
And throughout the night, that facade is systematically chipped away.
Exactly. Nick and Honey stay because they literally do not know how to exist outside those rules.
So they are trapped by their own politeness. But that politeness is just a symptom of a much larger lie they are all telling themselves. And that brings us to Act Three, the exorcism. This is the climax where the biggest illusion of all is finally shattered.
George arrives with snapdragons, and he prepares for the final, most brutal game of the night, which he calls bringing up baby.
Throughout the play, there have been these vague warnings and tense mentions of George and Martha's son.
Right, but here, George forces the issue.
Huh.
He demands Martha talk about him in front of the guests.
And as she tearfully recalls his beauty and talents, claiming George ruined his life, George starts loudly reciting the Requiem Mass.
The Catholic Latin Mass for the dead. He recites the Libera Me and the Kyrie Eleison, meaning Lord have mercy.
And then comes the twist. George tells Martha that the doorbell they heard earlier was a messenger from Western Union. He claims a telegram arrived stating that their son is dead.
And how did he die?
He was killed in a car crash when he swerved to avoid a porcupine.
Which is the exact wording George used earlier in his story about the boy who killed his parents.
Because the truth is, the son isn't real. He's completely imaginary. George and Martha are infertile, and early in their marriage, they invented this fictional son to cope with their painful reality.
It was a shared delusion to mask their inadequacy.
Yep.
But they had one strict rule.
Never, ever mention him to anyone else.
And Martha broke that rule. She mentioned the imaginary son to Honey earlier in the evening. Because she broke the fundamental rule of their shared delusion, George decides to brutally kill the fiction.
I mean, that imaginary son was essentially their marriage's emotional load-bearing wall. It was the shared fiction holding their entire relationship up, protecting them from their stalled lives.
Yes.
Once George knocked it down with that fake telegram, they were just left standing in the rubble of their actual childless reality.
And Albee himself confirmed that interpretation. He stated that the title of the play literally means "Who's Afraid of Living Life Without False Illusions?"
Okay, let's unpack this title because it feels like a riddle. Where did "Who is Afraid of Virginia Woolf" actually come from?
It's surprisingly casual, actually. Albee was having a beer at a saloon in Greenwich Village in New York, and he saw the phrase scrawled in soap on the mirror.
Just on a mirror.
Yeah. The New Yorker magazine actually reported seeing that exact same piece of graffiti in an espresso joint in the Village 5 years before the play premiered. It was just this dark intellectual joke floating around the university crowd.
But Virginia Woolf was a brilliant English novelist whose life was deeply tragic. She died by suicide in 1941, leaving a heartbreaking note to her husband. Naming a play about a brutal, unvarnished marriage after someone whose reality was so agonizing has to be intentional.
It absolutely is. And Leonard Woolf, her husband, actually gave Albee permission to use her name. But the joke is also a pun on the song "Who's Afraid of the Big Bad Wolf?" from the 1933 Disney animated short, The Three Little Pigs.
Oh, interesting.
The sources note that because the rights to the Disney song were incredibly expensive, they couldn't legally sing it on stage. So, in the play and the film, Martha and George sing the lyrics to the public domain tune of "Here We Go Round the Mulberry Bush." They use this silly nursery rhyme melody to mask this immense adult pain.
And it connects back to what Albee said about living without false illusions.
Exactly. He explicitly connected this to the philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche, specifically his idea of the Apollonian versus Dionysian dichotomy in human nature.
Okay, let's break that philosophy down because it sounds like the key to the whole story.
So Nietzsche argued that the human psyche is split into two forces. The Apollonian side craves order, structure, and polite illusions. It's the pate fence, the rules of etiquette, the neat categories of success that Nick and Honey cling to.
And the Dionysian side.
That is pure, chaotic, drunken, messy reality. Albee argued that after various historical shifts, you know, the Industrial Revolution, the World War Society lost its absolute truths.
Right.
Without fixed truths, individuals are left feeling very uncomfortable and inadequate. So we build Apollonian fantasies. We construct polite illusions to evade our own ugliness.
So George and Martha's living room is essentially Dionysian reality, violently ripping apart the Apollonian illusion.
Precisely. They built an entire imaginary child to avoid facing their infertility and George's lack of ambition. The climax of the story is the painful process of exercising that falsehood so they can return to the real world, however empty and painful it might be.
That incredibly raw depiction of truth versus illusion didn't just stay on the stage, though. It completely shook up pop culture and Hollywood.
Oh, totally. In 1966, they adapted it into a film with an absolute powerhouse cast. Elizabeth Taylor played Martha, Richard Burton played George, George Segal was Nick, and Sandy Dennis was Honey.
And all four of them were nominated for Academy Awards, right?
Yep, with Taylor winning Best Actress and Dennis winning Best Supporting Actress.
But bringing that level of raw Dionysian reality to the screen in the 1960s triggered a massive censorship battle.
It was a huge deal.
The president of the Motion Picture Association of America, Jack Valenti, noted that this was the very first controversial film he had to deal with. The language in Albee's script was considered shocking for an era still clinging to that squeaky clean nuclear family image.
The studio executives had a 3-hour meeting over just two phrases.
3 hours.
3 hours of negotiation. In the end, they forced the deletion of the word screw, but they somehow managed to retain the phrase "hump the hostess."
Wow.
It was a pivotal moment in breaking down the polite illusions of Hollywood cinema.
And the legacy of the story goes way beyond a 1960s censorship battle. The narrative structure itself, an older, incredibly toxic couple trapping a younger couple in their home and forcing them to witness their dysfunction, it's become a permanent trope in storytelling.
Oh, we see that echo everywhere.
Think about The Office, the legendary dinner party episode where Michael and Jan host Jim and Pam. The writers originally titled that episode Virginia Woolf because the dynamic is identical.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
American Dad did an episode where characters pretend to be a professor and his wife, invite a couple over, and eventually kill an imaginary child.
No way.
Yeah. And the show Our Flag Means Death used the exact dynamic for the pirate couple and Bonnie and Mary Read. Even Steven Soderbergh's 2025 spy thriller Black Bag is an intentional parallel with a married couple hosting a dinner party to investigate their coworkers. It's a psychological framework that just continues to resonate.
But, you know, the creator himself, Edward Albee, wasn't quite done analyzing his own work. In 2005, for a Broadway revival starring Bill Irwin and Kathleen Turner, Albee actually revised the script.
Right.
And this is the version that has been used ever since. He removed several elements, like early references to the son, references to George feeling he caused his parents' death, and he entirely cut a 7-page scene between George and Honey at the end of the second act.
He wanted to make the plot mechanics clearer to the audience.
So what does this all mean? I kind of have to push back on this revision. Doesn't removing the ambiguity kind of defeat the purpose of a play that asks what is real and what is an illusion?
It's a fair question.
If you clarify the plot too much, don't you lose some of that muddy, hallucinatory feeling that makes the story so haunting in the first place?
Well, if we connect this to the bigger picture, it raises a truly profound debate about art and ownership. When an artist retroactively clarifies their work decades later, who actually owns the truth of that piece?
Is it the creator?
Exactly. Is it the creator who technically has the right to tinker with their own script until the day they die? Or does the meaning belong to the audience, the critics, and the actors who spent 40 years interpreting its mysteries and finding deep resonance in that very ambiguity?
That's a tough one.
By streamlining the text to make it clearer, Albee might have accidentally stripped away the very shadows where the most interesting monsters hide.
From a boozy 1960s weekend salon in New York to a masterpiece that forces us to look at the lies we tell ourselves to survive. It's a story that traps you in a living room and refuses to let you leave until every single emotional load-bearing wall has been smashed to pieces.
And while the scale of George and Martha's deception is highly theatrical, the psychology behind it is entirely human. We might not invent an imaginary child to save our relationships like they did, but we all have shared fictions.
Yeah.
We all agree to look away from certain realities to keep the peace. So as we wrap up this deep dive, here is a question for you to consider. What are the games or the unspoken illusions you maintain in your own life just to avoid facing an uncomfortable truth?